Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Rich Cohen, author of The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. And we'll kick off our beach book selections for the summer season with my review of Terry McMillan's I Almost Forgot About You. I truly believe that Rich Cohen could write about anything and give it style, urgency, and new meaning. He's a Tulane graduate and the author of the New York Times bestsellers Tough Jews, The Avengers, Monsters, and When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead, written with Jerry Weintraub. Rich also wrote one of my favorite books about New Orleans, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. He's a co-creator of the HBO series Vinyl and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. His new book is The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Rich, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Always so much fun to talk to you. Now, you know, I've been reading your books for a long time, and all through that time, this book was waiting to be written. Your cover story for Rolling Stone, about the Stones, appeared November 1st, 1994. So what made you decide all these years later that the time was right to revisit this?
You know, part of it was I have kids, and I was listening to the music they were into, and I'm like, gosh, music sucks. You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, what happened to music? And I was sort of remembering the time when we would await the next record. You know, what are they going to say next? What's going to happen next? Where are they going to take it? And that would usually be the Rolling Stones, which was my favorite band. And I sort of thought, you know, that whole era, that whole age, which really was an age, where rock and roll was the most important thing and the album was the thing, had kind of died. And I always marked it to sort of the death of Kurt Cobain. And nobody had stepped back to write about it, write about what it meant, why it happened, why it ended, and also, you know, sort of celebrate it.
Yes.
And I felt like you could do this about a whole era, and you'd be doing it through one band, and the best band would be the Rolling Stones, first of all, because I think they're the greatest rock band. They lasted the whole entire time. They have such a crazy, interesting story, and I had spent a lot of time with them reporting for Rolling Stone, so I felt like I knew them as a fan, as a kid, and kind of, you know, as a journalist working for Rolling Stone. And later on, I was a co-creator of the HBO show Vinyl, so I was still kind of on the road with them later and working with Mick Jagger. So I felt like I had this unique experience and that the story, even though it seemed like it had been told, had never really been told.
Oh, not like this. I mean, really, it's one of the most fun books I've read in so, so long. Now, in almost all your books, you draw on your personal history. No matter what the topic is, you're able to weave something of your own life into it. And here, you're going back to your college years, which gives the story such immediacy and presence.
Yeah, well, you know, you said I went to Tulane, and I was a huge music fan growing up, but I didn't see a lot of bands. You know, I saw the Rolling Stones. I saw them in a place called Rosemont Horizon, which is a big arena. And I saw Bruce Springsteen in Soldier Field, where the Bears play. And in New Orleans, I suddenly was seeing people in places like Carrollton Station and Benny's and the Maple Leaf. I was seeing bands like Dash Riprock. And there was such power to a bar band in a little tiny place. And it sort of reacquainted me to what was so great about the Stones, which is the Stones are the greatest bar band of all time. And they came out of these little clubs in England. And by the time most of us got around to them, they were in these big arenas. And when I got to go on the road for the Rolling Stones, very early on, I was with them in 1994 when they did a little warm-up gig in a little bar. And it was like seeing a band in New Orleans. And you saw, oh, my God, this is the Rolling Stones. They're in a tiny little bar with 300 people. Everybody's drunk, everybody's mashed together, and they're playing this unbelievably powerful music. And when people would say to me, you know, I saw the Rolling Stones in Madison Square Garden or in Giant Stadium, and I didn't really like them. I'm like, you didn't really see the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones really exist in a little tiny bar at 2 in the morning when you're drunk and suddenly Mick Jagger has remembered who he really is and Keith Richards sort of found the groove. And to me, that experience of what a band should be, it all comes from my experience in New Orleans.
Well, it's fascinating to me that a lot of, I mean, you're able to admit that the Stones made some really terrible records, but you say that the blues always came back to save them. They always returned to that for a really great record. You're uniquely qualified for that because you have that long interest in the blues. I mean, your book, Mockers and Rockers, about Chess records is a testament to that longstanding interest.
Well, I grew up just outside Chicago, and that was Chicago's music. And one of the things I always laughed at was Chicago never had its great band, in a way. And it did. It's the Rolling Stones. The Rolling Stones made their first real record at Chess Studios, specifically to connect to that kind of music, where the last song on it is 2120 South Michigan, which is the Chess Records address and is an homage to that music and that company. So I do think that when you get to the Rolling Stones, it's kind of a long train that starts really in the Mississippi Delta, comes to Chicago, becomes electrified so it can be heard, turns into this new music, and is ultimately picked up by these guys in Britain because it was the only thing interesting going on the radio at a time after the Second World War when everything was very gray and depressed there. So I do think that you got to see the Rolling Stones through where they come from. My father always says, you got to know where you come from to know where you are. And there's a great thing you can look up. It's the Rolling Stones on stage at the Checkerboard Lounge, which is Buddy Guy's club, playing with all those guys in a tiny little club in Chicago. But I should be totally honest. The reason I first got into that music probably is because you'd go down to the Checkerboard Lounge and they would serve you wine when you were 15 years old.
Oh, now, a lot of what's important to you musically that you write about with great interest in illumination is the Golden Run from 1969 to 72, Beggar's Banquet to Exile on Main Street. And that's where you saw a lot of things come together for the Stones musically.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting what created this Golden Run. Those four records are four of the greatest records in rock and roll history, made almost one a year. And first of all, the Beatles had made Sgt. Pepper's, which was such a huge hit. It kind of threw everybody off course. Every band felt they had to respond to it. And that's when the Stones had this record, Satanic Majesty's Request, which is almost like a copy of Sgt. Pepper's, except it's not good. And a lot of people thought it was the end of the Stones because the record was so lost and they seemed so far away from where they should be. And I always thought it was good because it was almost like them bleeding the 60s and the psychedelia out of their system. It was necessary. Then not long after that, the Beatles sort of stopped touring and then ultimately broke up, and that kind of freed the Stones because the Stones had always been positioned against the Beatles. Like, they had to respond to every Beatles record, and they were the bad guys because the Beatles were the good guys. And suddenly when the Beatles stopped, the Stones were sort of forced to and free to find their own way and sort of be the leaders. And then they had this ability to bring in these incredible new people like Mick Taylor, who replaced Brian Jones on guitar, and the producer Jimmy Miller. And they hit this sort of groove that was different than the blues. It was new because it had this country infusion, probably via Graham Parsons, and guys like Merle Haggard and George Jones. And suddenly you had this new kind of music that just carried them from LSD, really, into heroin, and from sort of the high of the late 60s to the hangover of the early 70s. And you can sort of study all the history books you want about what happened, in the Vietnam era and after the 60s, but you do just as well to listen to those records and how the mood changed over time.
Absolutely. This is a book that's propelled by drama. I mean, because there are so many landmark experiences that define the Stones. Brian Jones' death, the first acid trip, the high-profile drug trial, Altamont, the women. I mean, that must have been like writer's gold for you, even though other people have written about them.
I mean, weirdly, it sounds ridiculous, but I sort of felt like, geez, if you do this right, it's like War and Peace for the baby boomers. Because what was amazing to me about the Rolling Stones was they cover this period we're talking about, it's like 20 years, and they interact with everybody interesting in the culture in those 20 years. And at that time, so you have Sonny Barger, started the Hells Angels at Altamont. You have their involvement with Jean-Luc Godard and the New Wave French filmmakers, with John Lennon, with Chuck Berry. They're involved with all these people, and it's pure soap opera. I mean, from sort of sleeping with each other's girlfriends to the drug overdoses to all the craziness that happened. And by the way, and then in addition, it's all in the songs. So if you know the story, you kind of hear the songs all over again. And one of the things I was really hoping for is, like, one of the most exciting moments of my life was hearing Honky Tonk Woman through my brother's closed door, which was locked to me. And it sort of made me interested in this music. And I felt that it myself is by sort of writing about it and hopefully reading about it, you can kind of experience those songs again like they're new.
I think you really do. I mean, because I spent the whole time reading this book with a CD playing in the background. So
that's the idea. That's the object.
I know. You didn't even need to have a CD with this book. We all have them, hopefully. Now, one of the things I adored about this book is that you have such interesting perceptions about the individual members. And sometimes you kind of toss them off. But, you know, just a few examples. When you talk about Mick Jagger as a kind of mystery, as someone who's really overexposed, but still a mystery. And you have this, an old man defined by sex is a curious thing. And it's true. It is true that he is. And a lot of aging comes into this because you talk about how almost everybody you interviewed for this book was old.
Yeah. Well, because basically these are guys who were born, like Bill Wyman, who was their bass player, actually has memories of German bombers over this town in England. So this is a generation that's almost my father's generation. And, you know, it's very strange because from the beginning, the Stones had been about sex. And now Jagger, I tell people, and they can't believe it, he's a great grandfather.
Oh, that is hard to take in, yes.
You know, so they're sort of exploring the outer limits. And when I went and did the stories, this record, Voodoo Lounge, had come out, and I was going to meet them. And the editor at Rolling Stone sort of said, you know, there was a very explicitly sexual song. And she said, like, the thought of Mick Jagger doing those things, this old man, at that point he was 50. Now he's 72 or whatever.
Lord.
It is like they're exploring the outer limits of how you can be a sex symbol into almost truly old age.
Now, I suspect, I could be wrong, I suspect that Keith Richards really is your favorite. Because you write about him as if he were this enduring Zen master, you know. How are we going to feel when he actually dies? I mean, the poor guy gets put on these lists all the time, saying most likely to die this year. That's a terrible thing to live with.
I know. Well, the thing about Keith Richards is he's the guy who didn't die. Do you know what I mean? Like, he was the guy who was supposed to die and somehow survived. And in doing that, it's like a near-death experience. You really get a sense of this is a guy who kind of lives, you know, while he's playing a song, he's enjoying the song. Mick Jagger's not like that. Almost no one I know is like that. And that's what's inspiring. That's why people connect to him. He seems completely grounded in this music, in what he loves. He knows what he wants to do, and he's doing it. And I think for most people, you don't really know what you want to do, but you just know whatever it is, you're not doing it. So when you see a guy like that, there's something deeply, deeply reassuring about it. And, you know, you sort of said when he dies, you sort of feel like, on one hand, he could die any minute. And on the other hand, maybe he'll never die. Because if he's lived this long, why stop?
Well, there's something about him that I find deeply moving. You know, he's a great book collector. And I've seen pictures of his library, and I'm always moved by that, you know?
Well, I found this old article about him written when he first moved into Redlands, which is this country estate where the famous drug bust happened and everything. And it was before all that. And the writer from some London paper, you know, 1966 or something, was just writing down what books were in his library. And it was amazing. And it was books that, you know, are real books that he had because they were interesting to him. It was like great sea battles, you know, and military history. And although here's a funny thing, which is, when after I talked to him, I came back to Rolling Stone. I said, God, he's so smart. He was reading Gibbon, The Decline and Fall. And somebody said, yeah, well, I interviewed him 20 years ago, and he was reading Gibbon then. I said, well, yeah, but Gibbon's really long.
That's right. It could take 20 years, dip in and out of it. And then Charlie Watts is such a model of how to be old and how to remain elegant. There's that scene where you're talking to him about style, and it reminds me of Daisy Buchanan looking at Gatsby's shirts.
Yeah, well, that's actually what I had in mind, in a way, you know, which is I'm sort of asking him a lot about his clothes. As a guy who wants to dress very well, but one, I don't have the budget for it, and two, I don't necessarily have the body for it, you know, the way he dresses, which is really emulating old jazz greats. And at some point, he listed who they were, and the way a guy like Miles Davis, you know, who was such a great dresser, and that's kind of who Charlie Watts is influenced by. And I said, I was asking about his clothes, and he said, listen, if you want to look in my closets, why don't you just ask? And I said, okay. You know, this is in a hotel room. And he opens his closet, and it's like Gatsby's closet in a hotel room with, like, the most beautiful suits lined up almost in color coordination. And the thing about Charlie Watts is Charlie Watts is a jazz drummer who is influenced by jazz, who will still tell you he doesn't really like rock and roll. And he gave this element to the Rolling Stones that no other rock band had, which is, here's the guy setting the beat who's slightly detached and isn't losing his head amidst everybody else who is. And it was really kind of like a little bit of cold water in the drink that really added to the Stones, I always felt.
Now, one of the things you write that I love so much is, the Stones are a story that I've studied all my life. I've studied it as the ancients studied war. It's my Hemingway, Dickens, Homer. I've studied it in books, on vinyl, and up close. Yet it keeps surprising me. So what were the surprises? What was left for you to find in this history?
Well, there was a lot of things. I mean, first of all, some things which were right in plain sight, which is that it took the Beatles to figure out how to write a Rolling Stones song. That was new to me.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that their first sort of original meaning not a blues cover, hit, and their first kind of hit that stayed on the charts was actually written by Lennon and McCartney, because they were able to stand outside and see what the Rolling Stones should be about and what they were. The Rolling Stones hadn't figured it out yet. They were still dressing like the Beatles. And they sort of realized, as Keith Richards said, when we arrived, the Beatles were already wearing the white hats. What did that leave us? You know, that there was going to be something dark and menacing and blue-collar in a way the Beatles weren't, who were presented as, you know, unthreatening and able to open the doors specifically to America. I actually feel like with Altamont, which was sort of the great tragedy that kind of ended the era, weirdly, though it's been so reported, I feel like there was new reporting that I did that people had never done. I found people that hadn't been interviewed, which was a surprise to me, because you feel like it's so, you know, picked over. And I think when the phrase you're quoting specifically what I was talking about was this thing that an FBI agent came, it was always rumored that after Altamont, Sonny Barger, who headed the Hells Angels, started the Hells Angels, believed that Mick Jagger had set them up as patsies, and the rumor was always that the Hells Angels had taken a contract out on the lives of Jagger and Richards. And a few years ago, an FBI agent came forward and said it was true, that there was actually a contract out on their lives and a plan to sort of kill Mick Jagger at Andy Warhol's house on Montauk, Long Island, which Jagger had rented, and that it even put into action with guys from the Hells Angels attacking via the sea on, like, skiffs. And Jagger was saved because the big swell came and overturned the skiffs and sent the Hells Angels into the drink. Now, there's this guy who said this. I've never been able to fully nail it down. It's like, is it true? I mean, there's no paper on it. There's just one guy's testimony. But it's like that kind of thing that is like, wow. I mean, just how intense it got and how long that feeling lingered, that was new to me.
Yeah. I'm curious about where this book took you personally, because every book you write such fascinating nonfiction, but it's never without a good bit of self-revelation, and it kind of moves you along to the next point in your life, and this one seems in so many ways more revelatory than most of your work. Was this your toughest book to write, I wonder?
Well, my mother died, which was a big shock, you know? I mean, it's a shock for everybody, sort of like understand the world in a completely different way, and things become both completely precious and weirdly without meaning in some way, some things. So, and I wrote this right after that, and I always felt like writing this book and getting into it was almost like the way that I sort of grieved my mother in some way, even though I think it's a book with like a lot of joy in it. It was a very intense experience for me, and I felt like I wrote it in kind of this, you know, trance and deep thought about the past and my life and the things that mattered to me and where they came from and what they meant. And that was all bound up with the Rolling Stones. So I don't know if I would call it tough, but I would call it a very intense experience.
Well, it's a very intense experience to read. I mean, in the most wonderful way possible. It reads as if you wrote it in some kind of fever. You know, it has that kind of energy and propulsion, I think, for the reader. And then, I can't believe that you have ended up living a mere bike ride from Keith Richards' house.
Yeah.
And you see him.
But it's not a complete accident, because on one of the tours when I was with them, we were flying on a plane after a Stones tour. I was on the Stones plane. I was actually sitting with Keith on their plane, and the plane was coming to New York. And I was living in New York City, but I'm from Illinois, so I don't really know the New York suburbs or the towns around it. And the plane sort of banked, and he pointed to this dark water, it's Long Island Sound, and this lights along the coast, and he said, "That's where I live. And every time I see it, I'm happy, because everything I love is down there."
Ah, what a wonderful way to think about any spot on the earth.
He kind of touched the place. You know, in my head, this area of towns where I live, which is not far from the Long Island Sound, was always sort of kind of touched with something special by him saying that and his love for it.
And I see you're taking guitar lessons, and I hope those are coming along well.
I'm getting better all the time. I still am terrible, but I'm better than I used to be.
Well, this book is certainly fantastic, so congratulations on it. We've been talking with Rich Cohen, whose terrific new book is The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. It is the perfect summer read. Rich, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Your love is strong, and you're so sweet. You make me hard, you make me weak. Love is strong, and you're so sweet. And someday, babe, we got to meet. A glimpse of you was all it took. A stranger's glance, it got me hooked. I follow you across the stars.
Beach reading season, so let's ease into it with a little fun. Isn't that what it's all about? You reach out your hand, and there's so many choices on the book table this week alone. Richard Russo, Stephen King, Terry McMillan. I picked up Terry McMillan's I Almost Forgot About You, read the first paragraph, and laughed out loud. So that's the book I went with. Dr. Georgia Brown is having another exciting Friday night curled up in front of the TV, waiting for a pizza and lusting over Vincent D'Onofrio's Detective Gorin on Law & Order Criminal Intent. Been there, done that, sister. And yes, I hear you when you fess up to deep desire for Benicio del Toro and Denzel and Brad Pitt and Ken Watanabe. Trouble is, plenty of men in sight, none within reach. So Georgia, a two-time divorcee and empty nester, successful in her optometry practice, but really, is that enough? Sets out to remedy midlife boredom, shake up her life a bit. Even her 81-year-old Mama Earlene is having a serious romance. Georgia decides that she wants to find her former husbands and lovers and resolve matters. Not forgive and forget, but forgive and remember and understand. She enlists the help of her trusted friend Wanda, and the two go down the list, playing a new kind of Jeopardy. It goes something like this. Nathan shouldn't have been the first. That's five words, Georgia. I roll my eyes at her, stand up, and start walking in circles. Darnell, first one to break my heart. How old were you? Don't ask me questions, you're ruining the flow. Okay, Dennis, dumb as a post. David, no ambition. Wardell, came in 30 seconds. James, number one, ladies' man. James, number two, bisexual. Brad, we already know he was the thief. Mark, mama's boy. Elijah, pathological liar. Thomas, freak. Good freak or bad freak? I ignore her. Graham, arrogant. Aaron, boring. Abraham, well. Philip, married. Frederick, inconsiderate. Harold, number one. Another freak, in vain. Harold, number two, bad hygiene. Glenn, vulgar. Steve, cowardly. Horace, no comment. Then it's on to Google and Facebook and blind dates and reconnections and a high school reunion that brings a blast from the past in the best possible way. But along with her rediscovery of her sensual self, Georgia takes some action to bring joy and artistic fulfillment back into her life, starts walking the walk for breast cancer to honor a friend. She even gets some great advice from her mom, who's plotting a wedding after her fiancé recovers from hip replacement surgery. I'm almost a century-old Georgia, so I don't need your approval. We have a long history and probably a short future, and we're going to make the most of our forever. Words to live by indeed. Suffice it to say, sweet and sassy Georgia gets her groove back in every way. Her love of family, her zest for friendship, her sensual self. Anyone who's ever been on Match.com or Google stalked an old lover will laugh along with her at the way life twists and turns. And in typical Terry McMillan fashion, we learn that the one we almost forgot about might be the one we'll remember forever. Also in typical McMillan fashion, laughter comes along with wisdom. I Almost Forgot About You goes down smooth, but with a kick. A reminder that life is short. Make the most of it. Don't wait. It's a perfect beach book. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Lauren S. Carden reads from and signs Fashion and Fiction, Self-Transformation in 20th Century American Literature, Tuesday, June 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Susan Tucker discusses and signs City of Remembering, A History of Genealogy in New Orleans, Tuesday, June 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. John Hart signs Redemption Road, Wednesday, June 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And the next meeting of the Maple Street Bookshop Book Club is June 9th at 6 at the shop. And Giovanno facilitates a discussion of There Was an Old Woman Who Loved Her Children Until They Moved Back In, a trio of novellas by Russian writer Lyudmila Petrushevskaya. Judge Edward Butler Sr. discusses and signs Galvez, Spain, Our Forgotten Ally in the American Revolutionary War, A Concise History of Spanish Assistance, Thursday, June 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Jay by Howard Jacobson, Saturday, June 11th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Tara Durio reads from and signs her chapbook, Last Waters, followed by an open mic, Sunday, June 12th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Garden District Bookshop presents novelist Sloane Crossley, whose most recent book is The Clasp, in conversation with Nathaniel Rich, Monday, June 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Patrick Maney discusses and signs Bill Clinton, New Gilded Age President, Tuesday, June 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. Sally Michelle Jackson discusses her new book, The Darkness That Waits, The Heilsing Cases, Volume 4, Tuesday, June 14th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And June 16th is Bloomsday. Come out and celebrate James Joyce's Ulysses at the Irish House, 1432 St. Charles Avenue from 6 to 8. Michael Allen Zell MCs readings by Jasmine Araujo, George Bishop, Chris Champagne, Addie Sitchens, Louis Maestros, and Chris Waddington, and yours truly. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.